serial startup founder, an AI expert, data scientist, but most impressively, he's a successful contestant on Love is Blind.
What does it mean to you to take a leap of faith?
Throughout life, we are faced with scenarios where we must take a leap of faith. In the context of a relationship, that means being vulnerable. You risk being rejected by that other person, and that's scary.
Is love truly blind? Your company, Alliance AI.
For all of us who would love to preserve consciousness in a digital medium or back up our memories, our personality, if that's even possible.
So what do you think about OpenAI, for example, and how they're dealing with questions of objectivity?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the Loaf Podcast, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're very lucky to be here with Mr. Cameron Hamilton. He's a serial startup founder, an AI expert, data scientist, and he's also a real estate fund manager. But most impressively, he's a successful contestant on Love is Blind. So Cameron, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much. Wow, what an introduction. I appreciate that.
Well, we've got to do justice to the man.
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for having me. You know, I've seen your podcast in the past, really love some of the guests you've had on. So it was a no-brainer to come on today.
Cool, man. I appreciate that. So we're going to start, head straight into the classic question, okay? And this is more of a theoretical question than anything. You've had the success, but others haven't. So Cameron, is love truly blind?
The perennial question. I believe that love is blind. Now, I will say that physical attraction does matter, right? I never was one to deny that. I think that having that emotional foundation first, the physical connection can grow over time. Now, for Lauren and I, that was never a problem. It was there from the start. So I can't really speak to what that's like, but I do still believe that the physical connection can grow. If you've already established that emotional base, I think you can grow that physical connection. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I actually watched your season a long time ago. I think it was 4 years ago now when it came out. I've slightly trailed off. My sisters have stayed a bit more faithful to the show. But just from watching that season, the kind of thing I get is that you realize that looks aren't actually the only thing that can break a couple after coming out. There's loads of other important factors, like how do they hold themselves in a social situation, how they deal with family and so on. So how important do you think those factors are in like a Love is Blind type of show? You think they make or break or work available?
I mean, watching now, there have been 6 seasons of the show in the US. You already know there's a Love is Blind UK that just came out. We've got Sweden, we got Japan. I've watched most of the seasons from most of the different countries. Not all, but the thing that we always see is the cracks start really forming when they come back from this vacation retreat, the so-called proposal moon, as they call it on the show. That's when the cracks start forming, because on the proposal moon, like a honeymoon, everything is sunshine and puppies and rainbows. You're getting that physical connection going. You are in a tropical location. Everything's easy breezy. You come back to your home country, your home city, and now you have to balance your careers. And in the pods too, it's very much this sort of pure experience where you're just having conversation, connecting. There's no responsibilities you have to worry about. You don't have your phone. You don't have television, social media. You're just focusing on that other person. So when you come back and all those distractions hit you, it turns out the relationship is a lot more complicated than you first thought. The physical part is really not the biggest deal. We've seen a few couples where that was kind of a problem for them, but it's really that, how are we going to balance? You know, what is my family going to think about them? You know, all these expectations that society has, maybe they had other people they were seeing before they went on the show. That happens way more than is shown, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. A lot of people waiting in the wing back home. So it's very, so many factors that can just easily rip a relationship apart.
You mentioned the physical, and I wanted to stay with that for a moment, because in one of your vlogs, you you mentioned how important the physical is to you. And I'm wondering how you think the physical and the romantic interact and how they interrelate. So obviously you guys, you and Lauren didn't see each other when you got to know each other.
Right.
But you've also said that the physical is love language for you. So how do you kind of square those two?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, we all have different love languages. I mean, every relationship is a mix of every portion of what matters. To be more specific, you have the emotional foundation. You know, do you have the same values? Do you see yourself managing a household in the same way? How are you going to balance your finances together? How, if you have children, how are you going to raise those children together? And then you have the physical aspect. I mean, I think it would be silly to deny that physical intimacy is a part of a relationship. If it wasn't, then it would really just be sort of a platonic friendship, right? The physical intimacy is a necessary part of a relationship. That's one of the reasons why we bond. I mean, that's the reason why kissing and other intimacy is shown on TV, and not just reality TV, but film and movies and all this sort of thing. So it's silly to deny that the physical intimacy is important. It may be in different proportions for different couples. But to have a great relationship, you really want to try to maximize across all these domains, the physical, the spiritual, the emotional, financially, are you aligned? You know, do you have the same family values? So there's not just one dimension where that's what's needed to have a successful relationship.
Obviously you guys have a successful relationship, but I assume it's not easy, especially being in the public eye. And I think that's one of the trickiest things about these like reality shows as well. How do you guys decide what to share and what to keep private, especially when there's this constant demand for transparency in order to stay relevant in today's media culture?
No, I think you said it. There's, in this line of work, being a public figure, being a content creator, there's an incentive to, you might say, share everything in your life. And you see some couples do, they'll have the camera right in the delivery room filming the birth, which is wonderful. And people have this very voyeuristic urge to see everything and to be nosy. Can't really blame them. I think that's pretty natural to have that voyeuristic urge. For Lauren and I, we said, even before the show came out, because we'd been married for almost 2 years before the show came out, we said, when it comes out, you know, our relationship has to come first, and we have to keep some things for ourselves, some things that we don't share. So I think to address this right out of the gate, you know, the number one thing that people ask us about is, when are you two going to have a baby? Right. Something that we, like, literally every single day people ask us about this. So yesterday on a local news station, they were talking about Love is Blind, and one of the journalists, so-called, said that Lauren and I were pregnant on the show. And that's not true. You know, we certainly wish that were true, but that's not true. So then we had to address it because they're broadcasting this on local news. People are tagging us in this, congratulating us on the pregnancy. And, you know, people will even interpret any sign as a sign that we're pregnant, when, you know, it's a very difficult thing, especially for couples who want to have a baby and they haven't had one yet. And then people assume you're pregnant. I mean, it can be triggering for sure.
Yeah, it must be tough, given especially the fact, I think, that you're maybe what we would call, at least in the UK, an unlikely candidate for reality TV. Because I don't know if you know, have you heard of Love Island in the UK?
Of course.
So Love Island is very much more a show where the people who go on are what you would expect from reality TV contestants. They're going on because they want to do it, and it's kind of fun and all this sort of thing. So I wanted to understand the casting process a little bit more. I know that you got picked and you didn't ask for it. But were you selected, or was it kind of a mass text that was sent out or something, or had your profile been found somehow? Like, that's the sort of bit I don't quite get.
No, I mean, and frankly, I don't quite understand it either. You know, I have a couple of prevailing theories, but you're right. I mean, I didn't seek this out, and neither did my wife, Lauren. It was something where casting reached out to us both. They found us both. Now, she had a social media presence before the show. I mean, it wasn't huge, but for the average person, it was very decent. For me, I didn't at all. I had maybe 200 followers on Instagram. I'd never used it. I think there's two things. So one was, I remember they were casting for this show called Married at First Sight, Second Chances. And I saw this line of guys outside of my office building one day. And, you know, a bunch of, you know, guys around my age all lined up. And I'm like, what the hell is this? I go to the front of the line. I talk to the person with the clipboard. I'm like, what's going on here? They said, hey, we're casting for Married at First Sight, Second Chances. Now, this is the same production company that also later produced Love is Blind a couple of years later. So I'm like, I don't think I gave them my contact info, did I? Or did they remember my face somehow and they like sought me out? The other theory is, I know for season one, at least, they were using Tinder and other dating apps, and they would pretend to be a woman. And some of them were just regular casting people who were women. But they would pretend to be, you know, looking for a date, and they'd be like, hey, we're actually casting for this dating show. Are you interested? So it may have been that too, because I was on the dating apps at the time. Frankly, I don't know which way was the way that they actually found me. But yeah, it's crazy because I'd always been a fan of reality TV. And like you said, I'm not the likely person because, you know, I have this background being a data scientist. I wasn't trying to be a reality star. I, you know, in living in Atlanta, there's a lot of opportunities to be involved in media. Like, I did a lot of extra work for, not a lot, but some music videos and movies, just as an extra background person. But that was the extent of it, really. So I wasn't looking for it, but it definitely found me.
Yeah, I mean, scientist, firefighter, I'm not surprised they picked you there. I think that's a bit of a no-brainer.
Very weird background, for sure.
Yeah, I know. I was telling Ollie, Love is Blind, but I'm sure I'm very glad that I can see you. not a surprise that they chose you. Very, very handsome.
Thank you. Yeah. Have you guys thought about Love is Blind? Because, I mean, I know they just did the UK, but they'll circle back, I'm sure.
I think I'm good, honestly. At this stage of my life, I might be a little bit young for the commitments that the show comes with. Maybe a little bit later in life. But I think for the moment, a little bit.
Give it some time.
I'm already taken, so okay. Not for me. But I think maybe Ollie will give it a go at one point.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Anyway,
you really never know, right? Because life, like, you just can't. I would have never predicted that this would have been how things turned out. You know, when I was 28 when I went on the show, and leading up to that, I thought I'll never get married, or I had no real interest in getting married. I didn't foresee getting on a reality show. So it's funny how life can work.
Yeah, reality—it's an interesting one. I mean, do you think that the fact that your relationship kind of started and was molded and structured in that setting—did you think that had any negative consequences, or do you think ultimately that was all quite positive?
I don't think there were any negative consequences from my perspective. My wife and I felt very comfortable in that environment, to be honest. It's funny, you know, when you first are getting filmed, you're very hyper aware of the cameras and the crew. But after about the first day, that stuff all faded into the peripheral. And I just focused on Lauren. And of course, there were moments when you kind of get shaken out of it. Like, I remember one time we were having a real kind of special moment, and they had cutouts in the pods for a camera lens to, you know, manually, someone operating a camera to kind of get closer. And I remember he kind of banged the lens of the camera on the glass of the pod so that it like kind of jolted me out of the conversation we were having. But to answer your question, I think we really had no real negative consequences. We felt comfortable when we got, in fact, actually when filming stopped, it was such a shock to the system because we were so used to being on camera together all the time. And then when there was no camera crew around us, none of this buzz, it felt a little eerie, you know, because there's this stillness, the silence in the air all the time, where before, you know, it was like very high energy, very emotional time. You know, this was all a whirlwind that took place over 45 days. So yeah, that was an adjustment period for sure.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Yeah, it must have been crazy.
Yeah.
But I'd like to move into AI if that's okay with you.
Sure.
We're super interested to talk to you about that.
So yeah, yeah.
Kind of my first question whenever I meet somebody who's has been into AI sort of pre-2023 is, you were obviously involved and understood it well before the advent of LLMs, ChatGPT, kind of what brought it into the public consciousness, what people call the new age of AI, right?
Yeah.
And my sort of question is, how visible was the development for you? Was this something that you saw coming or did think eventually would come?
Yeah.
How did that
totally
work?
Well, two major milestones for me. One was Ray Kurzweil, this futurist, very popular writer, had come out with a book called The Singularity is Near back in 2005. He had talked about his forecasts of what he foresaw for AI going into the future. And I had read that book back then, 2005. And that was kind of one of my earlier forays into AI. I had always been curious with how can we have a mechanistic understanding of the mind. That was from a very early age, my goal, like, can I understand the mind in a mechanistic way? And so AI seemed the most straightforward path to doing that. So the book gives a number of predictions about the future. Some have come true, some the timeline's been a bit off, but he kind of paints a very optimistic view of how AI will improve society, how we will approach human level intelligence with AI through incremental steps. Now, I don't think he quite knew the technical specifics of LLMs and that sort of progress that we've been made, but he did have, he was one of the first to do, I believe, speech to text models. So he worked on that, or actually was it text to speech? No, speech to text. Anyways, so he has a good understanding of AI and what's possible. The next thing was, there was a paper, and I'm trying to remember what year this was. Either 2014 or 2016 is in that range, but it was on the development of the transformer, and the transformer is a very fundamental technology that underlies these LLMs and makes them possible, and the attention mechanism, and both of those mechanisms make LLMs possible. So when I saw the development of those, I thought, okay, now all the building blocks are there for this new level of AI, higher level of intelligence. Because up until that point, artificial neural networks, well, when they first kind of hit the scene, and I don't know how technical you want me to get, but when they first hit the scene, they were kind of limited in how complex they could be. They couldn't really retain, they couldn't have a high enough parameter count to learn stuff that was super sophisticated in the way that LLMs can. But, you know, these developments that happened in 2014, 2016, they made that possible, and they allowed for these massive, massive networks where before, you know, you could have a network that maybe had a few layers, and beyond that, it was going to be redundant. Now they're, you know, hundreds of layers, thousands. I mean, just massive networks.
Yeah, I'm super interested that you kind of saw it coming to a certain extent once the right technical development happened. Because I think for people who weren't pre-interested in AI, let's say, it was kind of a shock to the system. And I think for a lot of people in the AI world, from what I understand, LLMs was also kind of a shock that that was what managed to make it work with artificial neural networks. Just because it's kind of a blunt instrument, it works by probability. And so in that way, it's quite different from the human brain. So I guess my question to you is you went in looking for an understanding of maybe if we could get a computational theory of mind. Has your research brought you closer or further from that belief that maybe that's possible?
Definitely has reinforced my belief that it's possible. I mean, is it the exact same way that the human brain produces language and produces these higher levels of intelligence? No, not necessarily. I mean, I do take sort of a functionalist perspective in that if we are able to replicate the same level of intelligence in AI by any means necessary, if it reaches human level intelligence in terms of what it can do, you know, can it write poetry? Can it solve math equations? Can it navigate, you know, and then later when it's embodied into, you know, robot or what have you, I mean, which is started to, OpenAI has already started doing that. You know, can it do all the physical tasks, play soccer, you know, walk the dog, whatever. You know, we as humans have a very general intelligence. We can do so many different tasks super well. AI for the longest time had a very narrow intelligence where it was an expert at one thing. You know, we had AI that could beat the world's chess master back in 1995, but it couldn't fry an egg. You know, it couldn't write a poem. So now we're seeing these LLMs have a more general intelligence. And yes, at the end of the day, you know, it is all probabilistic mechanisms, you know, effectively predicting the next token in a sequence based on the tokens that have come before it. Tokens being, you know, full words or partial words or punctuation. So is that the same way in which the brain does it? Not necessarily, but if functionally it can achieve the same things, then I'm on board for saying, you know, we've reached human intelligence, and we're not there yet. But I mean, look at the progress we've made recently. Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a bit of a cliche question, but I suppose I was wondering if you think that robots can have that level of consciousness, because I mean, for example, would we see robots competing on Love is Blind? Do you think that might be possible, humans and robots having some sort of relationship?
You know, I do believe that's possible. As to what the timestamp is for that, I'm not quite sure. You know, I even am hesitant to venture a guess of what the timescale is. But, you know, I do have sort of a physicalist perspective in the sense that, you know, if we take on the premise that we as humans are fully constituted by the physical particles that make us up, and that is what gives rise to our consciousness, then it stands to reason that that could be done with machines as well. You know, you might take the perspective that we're biological machines, and that given the right construction, we could do that artificially. You know, of course, it's not a very popular idea. You know, and I think it has to do with emergence. You know, I believe that consciousness is an emergent property of the physical interaction. So reducing it down to say, well, it's these particles interacting in this way. I mean, consciousness I see as an emergent property or emergent process of the physical interactions going on in the brain, the body with the environment. So long story short, I think it is possible. Now, are they going to be contestants on Love is Blind? You know, Love is Blind, like season 230, maybe. I don't know. I think that show will go on probably forever. Yeah,
there is definitely an interesting philosophical question about whether it is an emergent property or not, or whether there's maybe something more to it. I think probably I would, if I had to, I'd sit on the side of there being something more. But interestingly, I think your perspective from a philosophical point of view maybe raises greater ethical challenges for AI, right? Because
yeah.
First of all, you have to establish, and by the way, as I ask this, this is not a question that has an easy answer at all. So,
right.
But
right.
At what point is that going to begin to emerge? Are we going to be able to tell when it begins to emerge? And I guess most right. importantly, what do we do when the beginning of this consciousness emerges, and how do we value it against human life? I feel like there's a whole set of questions there.
Oh man, it is a tough question to answer. I mean, I take sort of a view that consciousness falls onto a gradient. I think there are critical, maybe marker points where we could say that it's gone to, you know, it's transitioned to a higher level of consciousness. But just taking the sort of professor, Giulio Tononi, he had come up with this theory of like an integrated information theory of consciousness, where basically, you know, there's gradations to consciousness, that the more information that you can process, the higher the consciousness is. You know, where the lowest level would be like a light switch, you know, flicking on 0 to 1, like that's sort of a binary information. Now for what, when we usually talk about consciousness, we're talking about like a self-awareness, right? You know, seeing ourself as a self in and amongst a sea of others and in the environment. So I think that's a critical thing to look at, is when does the AI start to have a sense of self-awareness, to differentiate itself from others, to have this sort of, I mean, I say, it, talking about consciousness can be tricky because it's so nuanced. You know, when we say like we have a sustained self, when we say that we have a sustained sense of self, there's a lot of research to suggest that what we think is a sustained sense of self is continually evolving over time. So how sustained it is, I mean, I know my name has been Cameron for the last 34 years and, you know, all the sort of narrative of my life. So I think that's at least good enough to say that there's some level of being sustained. But anyways, I know I'm kind of exploring a lot of avenues here, but I think that the biggest thing is when the AI starts to really see itself as an entity that is separate from others, and also that has its own motivational system. ChatGPT does not have its own set of motivations. You know, it's very intelligent. It can perform a lot of tests. It would pass a lot of psychological tests with ease, but it doesn't say, hey, I want to go out and study the birds outside today or something like that. Where, you know, as humans, we are intrinsically goal striving. You know, even if that goal is, hey, I want to watch a marathon of Love Island, you know, we're intrinsically goal striving. So that's another important component of when we start to look at, you know, when the ethics really start coming into play, when this entity, this AI entity is like, hey, I really need to catch up on Love Island. That's when we need to start being concerned. Yeah.
Yeah. Love Island is definitely a good place to, put the barrier, ethical consideration as soon as it happens. But just to stick the point, I guess it's a similar point of view to yours. Just to kind of stick the point and give my point of view, I think. I know you have a background in philosophy, so you might know what I'm talking about here, but I'm borrowing from Hume. And what he says is that to be conscious is to have a point of view, to have something that it's like to be that thing. Like, there's nothing that it's like to be a bottle. The bottle just is. But there is something that it's like to be a dog, even if that's a lower form of consciousness. And if I had to answer the question, I think I would say there's probably nothing that it's like to be any LLM yet. But then I think we would have a harder time answering that question, maybe, than goal orientation might assume, you know, like, even if it were able to follow goals, would there be something that'd be like for it to be chasing that goal or something? That would be where the ethical consideration would come in for me. I don't know what you think about that.
No, that's definitely a good point. I think that there are a number of subsystems that need to be interacting to trigger our sense of, hey, we need to start ethically considering this entity. I do think that the LLMs are a good start, you know, as a sort of cognitive mechanism that could be built upon with a motivational system, with a system that is self-referential. And like you said, and by self-referential, you know, having a point of view. Yeah. I mean, take it back to Hume. So I think that's really, you know, a good point to bring up.
Yeah. I mean, I think until it has its own point of view, there is an issue about the people who are then coding it. So it isn't autonomous yet. So until it's autonomous, then I suppose the question is, where does that agency come from? So so what do you think about OpenAI, for example, and how they're dealing with questions of objectivity and training bias?
Oh, man. Yeah.
I know these are very difficult questions that we're shooting at you.
No
need to give some kind of fully correct.
I appreciate it. I think these are the type of questions that we need to talk about. And, you know, a lot of the AI talk is very surface level. So I appreciate these deeper questions. Yeah. I mean, it's clear that the data that AI are trained on really matters most of all. You know, the algorithms, we've kind of established what works there. And even for simpler models, if you have amazing data, you're going to get great results. So, and we've seen so many historic examples of when unbiased data or just data that hasn't been properly sanitized or whatever is introduced to the models. That Microsoft had some Twitter bot back, I don't know how many years it was ago now, but it very quickly started having these sort of bigoted views from the data that it was trained on. I think was it trained on Twitter and Reddit data or something like that?
It's not surprising that it comes out a little bit bigoted, given the arguments you get on both platforms. But.
Right. But, you know, for humans, it's really no different. The environment that we are in really shapes who we are. I mean, it's you know, we have our own intrinsic biology, but then the environment that we're in forms us into who we are, and it's the same for AI. So we really can't be surprised that, you know, the data matters as much as it does. I know that, of course, with OpenAI, I think I've heard some people complain that they are putting their own political perspective into the data or removing political perspectives that don't align with their own. It's a tricky one too, because as humans, we're also sort of blind to our own biases sometimes. But I mean, it kind of goes without saying that, you know, anything that's bigoted needs to be sanitized from the data, and just, you know, pulling raw data from Reddit and Twitter and other social medias, oh man, it's so dangerous.
I think maybe the point of contention is that people disagree over what's bigoted and what's not. And I think that in itself is creating this debate. And I think another part of the issue is that people often look to like ChatGPT as a point of authority. So once you have AI growing and becoming this bank of knowledge, then when it has views that are biased, that can also become a little bit risky. I think OpenAI so far have done an okay job. So when I ask ChatGPT really difficult questions, even really difficult moral and political questions, it usually deals with them quite well and with quite sophisticated answers. I suppose, what do you think is now next for these LLMs or AI in general, and how do you think that might align with your own work that you're doing with AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, one of the problems that people have been talking about is that they've kind of run the well dry in terms of data, which seems crazy because the internet is massive and you would think that there would be more than enough data to train up these LLMs. I mean, I think the LLMs are quite good at what they've been trained to do. You know, if you're working on a programming project and you're like, hey, I'm getting this error, you can copy and paste the code in there. It can debug it very quickly. But you know, one of the problems that I've observed, and whether this is actually a problem or not, it's up for debate, but one thing I've noticed is, you know, it does great with problems that have already been established, but in terms of solving new problems that haven't been solved, you know, it's not really giving any answers that are novel per se. You know, it can do a great job of summing up the existing literature, the existing research, solving problems that have already been solved, which we might even say, hey, do we really want the AI to be making these discoveries or, you know, coming up with new ideas? Some people would say no. Some people would say, well, yeah, of course, like, because we might be able to cure diseases. You know, if you were to say, hey, come up with a cure for Parkinson's disease real quick to the AI, you know, we would love for it to say, okay, yeah, actually, if you, you know, modify these genes in this way, then Parkinson's goes away. But it, you know, currently can't do anything like that. I think a lot of people are interested in how they can make the process of like software development even easier with the AI, because, you know, if you were to say, hey, can you recreate Microsoft Word from start to finish? It would take a lot of back and forths with that AI to get even like the basic word processor app going. So of course, a lot of people would love to be able to just give one command and maybe a few adjustments and have it develop, you know, a full on app for you. A lot of people, you know, so I think in the business sphere, there's going to be more push, and wherever the money is, of course, that's where people want to drive the AI.
I know that the CEO of NVIDIA said that he thinks no code coding is going to be the future. I'm not an expert, but I think that's definitely possible. And that could be something that's really cool to see, because that's sort of still human led. I think as sophisticated as AI get, as long as we have actors behind, then it's not a bad thing, right? As long as you're able to have human agency kind of sit at the back of it, then it shouldn't be such a problem. But I wanted to ask you about, maybe so our listeners can also understand where you're coming from on this topic. Your company, Alliance AI. I know you guys build models yourselves, but you also do loads of other things. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the work you're doing there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, probably the most relevant to what we were just talking about is I've actually been working on how to take that next step and do more of the no code coding. Now, I write code I write in Python most of the time, but, you know, learned various languages over the years. But my thought is, how can we do this from a multi-agent approach? So basically instantiating multiple LLMs and having them basically be like a community where everyone's assigned a different role. They talk to each other and they work to solve a common goal with their own assigned expertise, and to keep that that conversation going. So it's funny too, because before ChatGPT came out, I was actually working on building an AI assistant for a number of years, building upon GPT-2. So, you know, ChatGPT started with GPT-3.5. I had an approach where I took GPT-2 and then I built a number of subsystems on top of that that would sort of do a lot of things. So GPT-3.5 is a single model AI assistant, where this assistant that I had built just built upon GPT-2, and it was a number of subsystem models. Like, one would, you know, correct for grammar, another one would identify, was this a declarative statement or a question? You know, so when ChatGPT came out, I was like, oh man,
all that work, frustrating.
Yeah, out the window. It really made me realize too, like, what am I doing? You know, it's just my colleague and I working on a lot of these problems. You know, we really need to build out our team. On a more business level, straightforwardly speaking, I'm working on a software for investors, specifically for the everyday person. Because what I've noticed is that, you know, a lot of people, and there's really no reason to blame them for this, but they just don't know how to assess a stock as an investment opportunity. Things like financial statements are totally opaque to them, and you know, you can't blame them for that. It there's a lot of reason for it to be opaque. So what I have done with this software is try to take those financial statements for a company and assess the business, and then break it down for the user in a very plain English sort of way to say, hey, they've been steadily growing their free cash flow over the last 3 years, or, you know, they have negative shareholder value, which means you might want to reconsider this because, you know, they have more debt than equity in the company, you know, things like that. The model will also predict which stocks are going to go up by 20% or more over the next 12 months. That's another feature of it. Another feature is that it estimates a fair value for the stock. So if the stock's going for $100, but the software estimates that based on its free cash flow, based on other factors, the stock's actually worth $120, you know, you might have something that looks like it's on sale in front of you, right? So that's the whole point of the software, is to basically empower the everyday investor to have a better understanding of the business that underlies the stock, you know, because the stock market is not the casino. It's not a lottery ticket. This is a partial ownership of a business. So as a partial owner, you should try to understand the business as best you can.
I think there'll be two stages when these kind of tools develop. First of all, already, it's obviously already successful. I've seen that you have it up and running live on your site, Freedom. So if anybody wants to check that out, we'll link it down below for anybody who wants to have a look. But my sort of concern is, once these get even better, or perhaps even more widespread, I'm kind of interested to see how it's going to impact the stock market as a whole, because
Yeah.
The stock market is kind of predicated on this information gap that people don't exactly know how things are going to move. And as it gets more sophisticated, I don't know where you see that might go, but you know, if these tools actually are able to perfectly predict what the fair price is, you know, we're never going to be very far away from the fair price.
No, that's a good thing to bring up. So there's this idea called the efficient market hypothesis. And a lot of people are, you know, devotees to this hypothesis and say that, well, you know, there's already too much information available so that, you know, everything is basically fairly priced and you should just buy something like the S&P 500 and just bank on the appreciation of that over time of, you know, roughly in the US, 10% a year for the S&P 500. That's what it's historically averaged. And I think that's great advice for the majority of people. We've seen that 90% of professional investors can't beat the S&P 500. So there's a lot of credibility to the efficient market hypothesis already. But we also see investors like Warren Buffett, Seth Klarman, who have done 20% plus. And 10% versus 20% doesn't sound like a lot on a linear scale, but when that interest compounds on itself every year, I mean, it's a humongous difference. So even if you can, you know, beat the market by 2% or 4%, I mean, that's huge. So now if this tool becomes widespread enough, of course, it would make the market even more efficient. You know, hopefully, I guess people jump on it sooner rather than later so that they can take advantage of it before it does get to that sort of more efficient point. You know, I hope I'm able to build a software that can encourage people to do that for sure.
Yeah, I think it's really cool the work that you're doing in general in the finance sector. And I think before we move on from AI and onto your work with Roots, I think maybe a last question. Something that really impressed me was your brain-computer interface.
Which you created.
Maybe could you explain and expand on that a little bit for our audience?
Yeah. Well, I've always been fascinated with brain-computer interfaces. So the project that I undertook there was to see whether I could control a drone in a four-directional sense with an EEG headset. So with just 16 electrodes, wanted to see if I could do four directional movement. And the idea was to imagine motor, movement. So just using motor imagery, basically imagining and coding that to imagining moving four limbs. So left hand, right hand, left foot, right foot. And those four imagined motor movements would then steer in one of these four directions. So I spent some time just sitting there imagining moving one of the four limbs and then taking that data to then code to these four directional movements and building a model to predict or to translate really, you know, if we're seeing this particular EEG activity, okay, that's imagining moving the right hand. If we see this particular EEG activity, that's imagining moving the left hand, because there's research that suggests that there's a similar activation pattern for actually moving the left hand versus imagining moving the left hand or, you know, this sort of thing. And actually too, to be a little bit more specific too, I actually used imagining moving the tongue and the mouth as the forward motion because our brain has more mapping for the mouth than it does for the feet. So if you look at, it's called like the homunculus map of the mind. Very cool to take a look at this. If you look at it, you'll see the mouth and the tongue, a huge portion of the motor cortex devoted there versus in the hands too. And then the rest of the body, like the torso and the legs, very little. The feet have a little bit more. So I try to take advantage of that, you know, amount of the motor cortex devoted to each up to the body proportionally to try to do this mapping. So that was a fun project. Now, the downside to EEGs are that, I mean, I only had 16 electrodes to work with, and, you know, we have 100 billion neurons in the brain. EEGs are really just looking at a population of activation of neurons. So, and you're working with, you know, electrical conductance off the surface of the scalp. So it's the skull gets in the way a little bit. You know, it would be wonderful to have, like, you know, a number of micro electrode arrays implanted in the brain. I know that's what Elon's company is trying to do, right? Or has done. But yeah, it's so frustrating because, you know, for all of us out there who would love to see a way to, I'm going deep into futurism here, but for all of us who would love to preserve consciousness in a digital medium, or, you know, back up our memories, our personality, if that's even possible. The biggest limitation I see is the current hardware that we have to do that. Now we've seen really cool stuff where, I don't remember where this, I think this was done maybe in China, I'm not sure, but they were able to take mental imagery of a person within a fMRI machine, and then use some of these image to image models that have been developed to then translate that mental imagery from the fMRI, that fMRI image reading, into what they were mentally imagining. Right? That has huge implications, I think. You know, you could use that technology to record someone's dreams, maybe, or, you know, record someone's memories. You know, if, as we develop this technology, obviously it's in its infancy. And I really would love to, I wish I could cite the specific paper that's pulled from, but it's just amazing that we have this capacity, and we're on the cusp of something really special when it comes to brain machine interaction, brain computer interaction.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and at the risk of inflating your ego, I think what you're doing is is really cool. And on that note, I mean, you're also, alongside all the AI stuff we've talked about, also have a project called Roots. Could you maybe, just for our listeners who might not be familiar with Roots, tell us what that's all about?
Yeah, so Roots is what's called a real estate investment trust. And effectively, it's an investment group that's purchasing a number of properties, rental properties. Right now, it's just in Atlanta in the US, but they're purchasing a number of investment properties that are being rented out to people. And they're very affordable too, relative to the area. And the idea is that not only are the investors getting returns on by investing into this real estate investment trust, but also the renters themselves, a portion of their rent is being invested on their behalf as a rebate if they take care of the property and they pay their rent on time and they're good neighbors. So, you know, you get a portion of your rent back invested for you. So the renters also get to be investors too, which has never been done before. And it's a win-win because for the property owners, the people who are owning these properties within the fund, a huge problem is that if you're used to the traditional model of renting, and I don't know how it is in the UK, but there's a huge amount of money that typically has to be spent per renter on repairs to the property after they leave. You know, that's why a lot of renters just assume they're never going to see their security deposit, because that has to go towards repairing the damage. And unfortunately, that's the way it is all over the place. But by incentivizing them to take care of the property, by having a portion of their rent go into an investment fund for them, so they're actually making money while they're renting, I think that's really powerful. And you know, a lot of people don't have anything invested. You know, some they may have a little bit of a savings, but they don't have anything invested, unfortunately. A lot of people don't. So people who go through this roots process and they rent for a few years, you know, they start to see they have a little nest egg that gets invested for them. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool idea to kind of have every stakeholder, i.e. every person who has some kind of interest in the place, actually get something out of it. It's similar to an idea we have in the UK of cooperatives. Like we have a supermarket called the Co-op, where every employee instantly by joining gets a very small percentage of the company, kind of like a wide partnership. So from your reaction, you haven't heard of it. So how did you come up with this idea of kind of having everyone get involved?
Well, I didn't come up with the idea, to be transparent. I am a partial owner of this company and not just of the investment, the REIT, but also of the larger company that owns Roots. So they actually, that also includes the software itself that allows property owners to set this sort of up, because we're expanding to outside of Atlanta and giving people who own these, you know, single family homes or multifamily homes, the ability to do this as well. But as I didn't come up with the idea. It was some of the people I work with who've been in the real estate game for a number of years who really came up with this. Yeah.
It must be a lot juggling so many things at once. And, you know, at the same time, you're married, which, you know, it's a job in itself, maybe a fun job, but still a job.
It's still a job. Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading through your book, Leap of Faith. And
I guess
maybe the book that you co-wrote with your wife, for those who aren't aware, I suppose as a nice summary of all that we've discussed.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you to take a leap of faith?
Oh man. I think that throughout life we are faced with scenarios where we must take a leap of faith, right? And to me, it can mean a number of things. In the context of a relationship, that means being vulnerable. A lot of us, and I hear this almost every day, are afraid to be vulnerable, because by being vulnerable, you open yourself up to being hurt. You know, if you confess your weaknesses or things you've done that you're not proud of, or that you like someone, that you have feelings for someone, that you're interested in being more serious and being more committed, you risk being rejected by that other person. And that's scary. But you do have to take that leap of faith in order to deepen your relationship with that other person. So that's something that I try to encourage people. Being vulnerable is a strength. It's not a weakness. You know, if you're willing to show your emotions, even cry, you know, that's not a weakness. That's a strength, because so many people are so afraid of the judgment from others or the rejection from others by showing their emotions, by telling people how they feel, their fears, even that they didn't like something, you know, standing up for yourself. You got to take that leap of faith. There's also other types of leap of faith. So my wife and I are actually launching a podcast in October. It's called The Love Seat. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yes. We're launching a podcast. What's that?
We'll definitely tune into that.
Yes. Please tune in. It's going to be dropping in October. It's called The Love Seat. But for us, that was a big leap of faith, because we've invested a lot into this podcast, money, time, energy. You know, we feel like there's a lot riding on it. We really wanted to have a big rollout. So we've been doing like a full marketing workup and PR, set design, the work. So I think it's scary to invest in yourself. You know, could have just taken that money and put it in the S&P 500 or put it into, you know, something that's already been established, but we decided to invest in ourselves. And I personally think that's the best type of investment that you can make, is investing in yourself. You know, whether that's you have this vision for a project that you always wanted to do and you put the money and the time into it. Yeah. So you gotta take leaps of faith. You know, a lot of people, the idea of working for themselves really scares them. It's like, you know, you can, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing a 9-to-5 salary job, being safe. But if you're not feeling fulfillment, you know, you got to take that leap of faith.
Well, thank you, Cameron. I think that's a very nice and profound note to end on, especially given we were talking about flying drones with our brain about 15 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago.
But, you know, let's go all over the place, man. I that's how it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Cameron, thank you so much for coming on. This has been the Loaf Podcast. Signing off. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Cameron Hamilton. If you want to see another episode where we discuss the ethics of AI and much more, our episode with Robert Wright, you can click right here. And if you want to keep getting cool guests, please like and subscribe. It really helps the channel and it keeps us going. See you guys next time.